I'm Jackie Vetrano from the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
And I'm Logan Bishop from Belmont University. You're listening to Higher Ed Social, part of the Connect EDU network.
Welcome to the show then. I think Logan has probably already hit record because that is his MO.
I did just a second ago, yes.
we're very, very glad to have you, and we'll have you start by introducing yourself.
Well, hi. Thank you guys for having me on the show. My name is Nicholas Cifuentes Goodbody, and I'm the Associate Director of the Language Center at the University of Southern California.
How long have you been there?
I've been there now for just about a year.
Oh, great. How's it going?
Happy anniversary. Well, thank you. I really appreciate it. It's good. You know, I really, really love being in Southern California. We just moved here from, before this I was in Qatar. So it's a very big change in sort
that
of the
is,
dynamic.
Yeah. That is a change, yes.
Yeah, big change. And it's going very well.
Climate-wise, how different is it?
Well, you know, I guess they're both deserts.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. They're probably both that Mediterranean, dry, almost desert level. Probably more
definitely.
Qatar than Los Angeles, but yeah.
Well, you know, Qatar is just this little peninsula, and it sticks out into the ocean, so it's very, very, very humid. So it really could be like 130 degrees and 100% humidity. So this sort of dry heat, I'm loving it.
Yeah, I thought, in here I thought it was bad. I live in Tennessee, and... You know,
exactly.
80 degrees with 100 degrees humidity is like, ugh.
No, right. So you know exactly what I'm talking about. Yeah.
No, that sounds like a different level of hell there.
Imagine if you sort of like, you open the door and it's kind of like opening the door to your oven if you're baking something.
Oh, that's not fun.
Yeah. That's in the summer. In the winter, it's super nice, actually.
I would imagine that. I was out in like California recently, and that weather was very... nice. Like it started to make me understand the concept of dry heat. Like, okay, I kind of like this, but it wasn't.
Yeah, but it was in the 80s,
so
Jackie.
Right. That's the thing is that it was still a nice temperature.
But if you go but that was like cool for San Diego. I mean, it gets up into like over 100 down there, and I imagine that's not fun either.
No. I don't know how you did it. I really don't.
I was in Phoenix when it was 120 degrees. And everybody was like, it's just a dry heat. And I'm like, I'm jumping from palm tree shadow to palm tree shadow. Dry heat's no better. It's still heat.
No, yeah. It's like if you live in Minnesota in the winter, you know, you kind of try to avoid going outside, or you come up with all sorts of tricks. It's kind of the same thing in the summer in Qatar.
Yeah, Jackie, it's like you in Buffalo in New York in the winter.
Actually, no, it's very similar to Buffalo. That's a good parallel.
That's so funny. So what was it like to go to Qatar? Was it, I mean, obviously the weather, but being like working abroad versus just traveling must be a little bit different, right?
No, I mean, absolutely. I don't think it would be an exaggeration for me to say that it was totally life-changing. You know, I had lived abroad and taught abroad before, but going to the Middle East, and I was working as a professor of translation studies there, and helping them also set up a Spanish program. And it was just amazing. I mean, imagine you're sitting around a table with 12 different people, and they're from 12 different countries and like 5 different educational systems. Mm-hmm. And you just kind of need to hash it out and decide what a B+ is. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Usually when you're, you know, if you're in the US and there's a lot of diversity in the academy, you can kind of fall back on the U.S. default. But there you really had no default, so you really had to all hammer everything out. It took a lot of talking, a lot of intercultural negotiation. And it's just, you know, you meet people that you would never meet anywhere else. So it was just amazing.
That's so great. Would you ever consider another abroad stint?
Oh, 100%. Do you have one in mind? Are we going now?
No. Oh, God, I wish. If someone would like to fund us, any of our listeners would like to send us abroad to work, I am willing to go.
Yeah, definitely. Yep. I hear everywhere else but here is nice this time of year.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and when you know, sometimes we think about the academic job market being very tight here in the U.S., And you have to remember that a lot of the skills you have are very unique and they are very valuable, right? Maybe if not here, looking abroad is always a great option. So I 100% recommend it, and I would totally do it again.
Mm-hmm. What was, I guess, one of your biggest challenges or obstacles when it came to kind of learning how to be in this new culture?
I think when we think about higher education in the US, it is very deeply connected to our society. And by that I mean a lot of what we do when we're teaching in the US kind of has to do with teaching what we think of as democratic values. You know, how do you be a good citizen? How do you critically engage with a text, whether it's, you know, a novel or whether it's something a politician is saying? And that sort of, you know, democratic norm is underlying a lot of the way a class is negotiated and taught. And when you move to a part of the world where that's not the norm, you know, it's a very, very different dynamic. And it's still super interesting and there's still a lot of exchange, but I think it can be kind of a shock to see that what you thought was sort of the underlying foundation of education is very different.
Yeah, that's what I found interesting, because our entire higher ed system is based off of kind of a democratic federal process, if you really think about it.
Exactly.
Each of the colleges tend to administrate themselves, kind of like states administrate themselves. You have a larger grouping of people that have representatives from each of those individual colleges that make up a faculty senate.
Exactly. That,
you know, govern, self-governance kind of deal. So yeah. I always thought it was interesting because 'cause the politics of higher ed, and in particular large universities, work a whole lot like, you know, said government sometimes, and the speed at which things move and the rarity of compromise. So, yeah. I always found that interesting, and how that, I never thought about how it, just that general idea would be different in another country, especially one that's not necessarily free.
Right. Exactly.
So, I mean, how is it different?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about in terms of governance, it's essentially, I mean, Qatar itself is an absolute monarchy, but, you know, the way the university is run is the boss says this, and then that's going to happen. And in some ways that is super helpful, because if you're, so like I was a coordinator for the master's program that we were doing, and we had to do an international accreditation with the University of Geneva. And it is extremely helpful to get together your 8 or 10 faculty members and say, listen, this is the agenda and this needs to be done by this date. And so we all need to get on this project together and get it moving. And you can get things done really fast, you know? And if you come back to the US and you're trying to put similar processes into place, it is definitely a cultural shock. So yeah, I guess you could say that it's a much more of a top-down management style.
So you're saying people in the U.S. are kind of difficult to work with.
as a university administrator, I would never say that.
I'll just say it for you then. It's okay.
Okay, good. You can take that off my plate.
So, I lost my train of thought.
I could tell. I was going to let you roll with it, Logan, but...
I lost it. You made me laugh too hard.
Well, I have a question, tangentially related. Like, what was it like coming back? You kind of mentioned this, obviously, like the way things get done is a little bit different, but was there anything else kind of like reverse culture shock, I guess, if that's the right phrase, that happened when you came back?
I think, yeah, that's an excellent question. I would say that I was, I think sometimes when you're abroad, you can get into sort of an expat mentality, where you say, oh, everything is better back home. You know, everything's gonna be better when I get back home. Everything's gonna be easier and more efficient. And when it's not, you're sort of like, oh, well, maybe I wasn't appreciating. Or maybe things weren't as great here as I thought they were. Or, you know, maybe they weren't as idealized as I thought they were. And in terms of what else, I would say, coming back to California was just like an amazing breath of fresh air. You know, it's such a open place. it's people from all over the world, and they're all, you know, participating and doing things together. That's really exciting. So on the one hand, it was very refreshing. Also, the food's great here, which is great. Food was great there too, though. And then on the other hand, you're sort of like, oh, I thought things would be a little bit more smoother. But you end up sort of running into the same, you know, bureaucratic obstacles that you would hit, you know, in any university in any part of the world.
And that's really the life.
Yes.
The bureaucratic stuff.
Yeah.
So in your new role, like, is it obviously not the same, but similar type of responsibilities? Are you seeing the same kind of pattern in your work, or is it a totally new ball game for you?
I would say it's about 90% different. In my old job, I was doing research in translation studies, and I was running the master's program and then also teaching. So, you know, basically your standard professor gig. And then here, it's 100% administration. So I'm working with all of the language directors of all the language programs we have at USC, sort of the basic language, the level one, level two, level three, and helping them put together assessment cycles or assessment plans for their programs, and then running all of the placement tests for all of the students that come in every year to USC. So it's much more administrative, and I'm much more in a support role, whereas in Qatar, I was in a leadership role.
So which do you prefer?
I don't know. You'll have to ask me in a couple of years.
So far, how are you enjoying this just new change as associate director?
Well, I would say, you know, if there's one thing I miss about Qatar, it was that things were very fast paced. You know, a single academic year there would feel like 3 years here. And so I do miss that sort of get it done kind of pace of things. And in terms of things that I'm enjoying here, I do think there is a lot more freedom in sort of pursuing new projects and learning new things when you don't always need to worry about them being tied to a specific discipline. Like, for instance, I'm doing a lot more work in programming. You know, I've taught myself a lot of data science and a lot of Python because it's useful for my job here, but I probably wouldn't have had the motivation to do it as much if I were still in Qatar.
So that actually brings me to a thing. So you're going from doing, you know, humanities, language, all of this kind of fun stuff, translation, to doing more of this data science thing. That's definitely a change, transition-wise. What is it like, you know, moving from something so different, something that's, you know, language, history, humanities, over to science, math?
Yeah. Right. I mean, I guess the short answer is it's a lot of fun. The long answer is, you know, I started in Latin American literature, and then when I moved to translation studies, there's this whole branch of the discipline that is very quantitative and sort of almost like linguistics or like corpus linguistics. And that's how I started getting interested in learning R and learning Python. And then it just sort of kept rolling when I came back to the US. And I gotta say, it's a lot of fun because sometimes when you are studying in the humanities, you're kind of reading along things, but you're not always sure how it's all going to connect together into like a larger project. Whereas when you can kind of take charge of it, or I would just say, the way I'm learning now is much more project-based. Like, I need to do this at work, so how do I make that happen, you know? And so it's, I gotta say, it's a lot of fun, maybe just because the instant you learn something, you have to put it into practice. You know what it's like? It's almost like when you're learning a language and you learn a new word, and then all of a sudden you hear it everywhere. So maybe it's not that different in the end. I don't know.
I'd never thought about it like that. I mean... Yeah. I mean, I started out in the sciences, and I've kind of moved into video, cinematography, and marketing, which are all like very different than the stuff I've done in the past. So I think I have a little bit of a feel for what you're talking about, though. I never did the teaching thing, or I was never in the humanities. So at least some of it is still some data, some, you know, the marketing stuff, the data understanding, seeing patterns and analytics and all that kind of stuff. I totally get that. That's just awesome.
And your storytelling, you know, you're finding what's the narrative that brings that data together. So there's a lot of similarities.
It is.
I'm curious, what sort of motivated your change from science to what you're doing now?
Well, I don't know, to be honest. I started out studying biology in college, and I graduated with a degree in biology with a minor in geology, and then I kind of went into this little phase of, I don't know what I want to do with my life. I can either go to grad school or I can do something else. So I just decided, hey, I'm just going to go work at Dell for a little while and figure out what I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
My parents lived abroad, so I really didn't have any direction from them to help me. So I just kind of worked for Dell for a little while. And then I got laid off and a job opened at the university I work at now, Belmont University. And because of my, they were looking for an IT person in admissions, and, you know, I worked at Dell, and I was like, this isn't what I want to do for the rest of my life, but, you know, I got laid off and here's Belmont. Let's go work here. So I worked there. I worked in admissions. I did very little IT stuff. I just kind of helped them launch a CRM, and I realized, oh, wow. You know, admissions marketing is fun. And then the university said, cool, you should do marketing for the whole university. So they picked me up and they moved me over to marketing. And I started social media and, you know, became the university videographer, and just many things happened. And I just kind of fell into what I'm doing. And while it isn't exactly what I wanted to do necessarily starting out, I've definitely found that I love working with students and helping students make a difference. And I think, and part of me, when I was in biology, I always thought, you know, I want to make discoveries and I want to change the world. And part of the reason why I got disillusioned is because I realized that the days of the Darwins and the, you know, Teslas and all this other stuff, the days of that are kind of over. And now everybody has, as my biology professor used to say, everybody has a needle and they're all on the inside of a giant balloon, and all the discoveries that you make fit onto the top of this little pin top, and you just push the balloon out just a little bit further with your little discovery. And I'm just like, meh, cool, but not so cool. So I guess now I just enjoy making a difference in a different way. How's that?
No, I like that. So, I like that.
So there you go. There's a story of how Logan decided to not do biology. But one of these days I will get my master's degree. Other people around me, like Jackie or my wife, have both gotten their master's degrees or are currently working on theirs. So I guess it's Logan's turn, and I just have to figure out what I want that degree to be.
Yeah.
So,
you know, don't rush it. You know, it'll find you, you know.
I don't know. I'm 35. I need to probably, or sorry, 37. I'm 37. I'm 37. I need to figure it out probably more on the sooner rather than later. I feel like because once you hit 40, I mean, really. Is a PhD going to be a thing?
You'll never hit 40. You'll always just be 3 years younger.
I know. If I'm going to lie about my age, I should probably pick one lower than 35, right? Oh, well.
I you know, do whatever they'll believe, you know, push it as far as you can. It's so funny you say that because I'm 38 now.
And, you're close.
I'm close. And I actually got accepted to the MS in business analytics at USC. And I was thinking the exact same thing. I was like, should I do this? I mean, you know, am I at this age? Am I going to be able to make that switch? You know? So I very much, what you're saying very much resonates with me and my situation as well. So I think we should both go for it, I guess.
You also have two master's degrees and a PhD. So
yeah, but I mean,
so you're well versed in this.
I don't know. They're not doing me a lot of good right now, so I'm not sure.
I feel like
I don't know. They sure look good.
They look good on the wall.
Indeed.
Too funny. Well, I wanted to ask before the saga of Logan about Data, because I love Data, and how are you finding it helpful in your job that clearly in the beginning you didn't think needed Data?
So let me give you an example. So for example, USC, their student information system was built in the 70s, and they're still using it. And so that means it predates SQL. So a lot of the database, you know, a lot of the advantages that come with relational databases are a little bit not easily at the tips of everyone's fingers that work in administration at USC. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So there's sort of a lack of analytic insight. And so I can use a lot of the skills that I've acquired through the self-study that I've been doing to help analyze the data as it comes in from different parts of the university. Sometimes it's hard to get clear numbers on how many majors are in each majors and minors for the, you know, 19,000 undergraduates. It's hard to get an overview of all of those. So I might do something like that. I might look at the different rosters for different language programs to see how students are doing, and being able to sort of quickly build reports and do those visualizations either in Python or in Tableau is super helpful for my boss or for the deans. So that's the kind of work that I would do.
Very cool. So what's on your desk right now? Like, what's on your to-do list right now in the semester?
Well, we have a big, every year we take a random sample of students across all of our languages, and we give them proficiency tests using the sort of the standard that we hear use in the US called ACTFL. And we're collecting data over several years in order to get a better understanding of the level of proficiency that students have when they fulfill the language requirement at USC. So most of October and November are going to be me running those tests and bringing in those students and then analyzing that data. So that's the big thing on my plate right now.
Wow. How many students do you bring in for that?
You know, that's a really good question. I haven't pulled the rosters yet, so I don't have a good, but it would be about, it's going to be, you know what, I'd have to do the calculation, but it's going to be anywhere between, no, you know what, I have absolutely no idea. I should have a better idea. That's what I'm going to do on Monday.
There we go. That's on your list. I was just curious if it was like several hundred or several thousand.
Well, it's definitely several thousand students that are taking language courses at USC. Right. But we're not going to get even right to 100 in terms of the how many we can sample in a semester, just because doing those proficiency tests is a pretty intensive process.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what is, I assume it's like writing and speaking?
Exactly. So you have to work with a service that'll pair up that student with a trained tester, and they'll do a speaking proficiency test. And then there's also a writing proficiency test where they'll be given a prompt and they have to write a response to it.
I'm having like PTSD to when I took AP Spanish in high school. And
yes.
Yeah. And like, that was terrifying to me.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally understand.
Is this a uniform like proficiency test across the state, across the country, or is this something that USC does individually?
So ACTFL, the ACTFL standard or proficiency levels are nationwide. And then each program needs to connect or articulate those proficiency goals to the way that their specific language program works. But the proficiency levels themselves are national. It's a national standard.
Wow. I guess I didn't even realize that. Probably because I wasn't studying a language in college, but I guess I didn't realize that was something that colleges did.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times language programs don't peg their outcomes to national proficiency levels. They just kind of take students and move them through Spanish 1, 2, 3, depending on how much they can get done in a semester and what's in the textbook. So right. What USC is doing is pretty unique in that regard.
How cool. And is this something that, like, when you sample, is it all students, like undergraduate, graduate, freshman, sophomore, junior, or is it a certain level of student?
So students at USC need to take, they need to study up to level 3 in a given language or place out. And so it's going to be all undergraduate students, and they'll be mostly in the sophomore, junior range. But it'll run the gambit from freshman to senior as well.
Wow. And when they take these like tests, do they know that this is just for sampling and not for a grade? Because I would be so nervous.
No. What we do is we make it worth their while. We give them a gift certificate to the bookstore. We give them a certificate that they can put on their resumes. So we try to make it a plus from them. And obviously we explain to them that it's above and beyond what they're doing in class. Yeah. And it has nothing to do with their grade.
Right. Do they get to find out how well they did?
No, yeah, absolutely. They can get a piece of paper and they can put it on their wall.
Wow.
Yeah. Nice.
And so it's a real win-win.
Is it like I survived the proficiency test?
I survived the proficiency test and all I got was this certificate. Yep, that's exactly right.
I made 99th percentile. I imagine you give them something like that, right?
Yeah. I mean, you say, you know, I got intermediate mid or intermediate high.
Cool.
Yeah.
I wonder what the training is like for the folks that you hire, like what they, you know, what they have to look for and listen for and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it has to do, I mean, it varies a little bit by language, but the it has to do with the sort of complexity with which a student can convey their thoughts. Mm. Yeah. And in fact, another neat thing about USC is that all of our, all of the instructors who teach those basic language courses are also certified to test students. And they don't do the testing, obviously, for our students, but they have that knowledge base that they can use to build the curricula for their classes.
Hmm. Oh, that's neat. That's a nice little advantage.
And that's a little, and then it can also, you know, if they want to do that and have that as a side hustle, do that sort of testing, it's also a nice little advantage for them.
Right. Well, it also helps them in the classroom, of course.
Yeah.
Indeed.
Very cool.
Assessment's really important these days in higher ed too, so more experience,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Are there any trends that you're seeing? Like, is proficiency going up exponentially, down sadly? Anything interesting that you've noticed?
You know, I haven't spent a lot of time with this set of data so mm-hmm. far, but I would say there's nothing, I would say that the students are exiting with levels of proficiency that you would expect for the number of hours that they've studied. So right. Nothing sort of mind-blowing, just that everyone's doing their job.
Which
well,
is
good news.
Good thing.
Good news.
Nobody slacking, everyone's doing their job. That is the key to success, I guess, for any measure of success, I guess. Well, I think that's all the time we have left on the show this week.
I think so. This was so great. It was so interesting to talk to you, Nicholas. Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you guys. It was a real pleasure to chat with you and hear a little bit about what you're doing as well.
Yeah, we really appreciate it. And listeners, of course, we appreciate you sticking around as well. You can head over to our website, highered.social, and you can get links to all the great stuff we talked about today, including ways to connect with Nicholas.
Yes.
And you can also subscribe to our show pretty much anywhere you get podcasts, as well as our website. If you like the show, please give us a review. We really appreciate it. It helps other people find the show and also lets us know if you like it. You can also follow us on Twitter. We are at @HESpodcast and definitely send us a tweet. We love talking to you. And of course, if you want to be on the show, you can tweet us because we want to meet you. Higher Ed Social is produced by the amazing Emma Hawes and is part of Connect EDU Network, which is the first podcast network for higher education. You can visit the website connectedu.network and subscribe to some amazing shows no matter where you work on campus. Have a great week.